gentlemen, it's the Stephanie Miller Show.
It's the Stephanie Miller Show. Good morning to you and happy holidays. I'm Hal Sparks. I'm filling in for Steph and Jim and Chris while they are on vacation. Today is our last day. Tomorrow's a holiday and Friday, so we won't be on the rest of the week. But I will be back Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday of next week as well, filling in so that they can get some much-needed rest and Steph can get settled into her New York apartment and stop her dogs from puking all over the place and finally get them a dog door. I guess apparently in her apartment, the landlord will not let her modify her apartment, you know, and put in one of those dog door things like for the sliding glass doors or to the outdoor area because of security reasons. Because apparently she lives in New York City and her dogs are the size of a couch. So I guess even the most rotund of criminals could wiggle their way into her. It's one thing when you have a cat door on your, you know, and like a criminal would just be able to, they could only steal things within an arm's reach of the door, basically, as long as your keys are basically out of reach, you're fine. But in her case, you could actually probably drive a Mini Cooper through her dog door. Those things are huge. So hopefully she's working all that stuff out. And hopefully Chris is actually getting some sleep today because, quite frankly, he's been following on Twitter. I'm surprised he's not in the chat stream on Ustream right now, you know, in the chat room. Yeah, totally. It wouldn't surprise me at all. And then, of course, Jim has got to be comatose right now. He's really enjoying it. He, if everybody, has the ability to kind of relax and enjoy himself. So I hope so. And it's really great to be here with you guys. The shows have been really fun and really great. Apparently, I'm streaming live on Ustream. I call it the Hal Sparks Hot and Sexy Cam Show, for obvious branding and sex sales reasons. And you can join in the chat there. You can also follow me at Hal Sparks on Twitter, and I can also we can interact that way. And the nice thing is, so I just did this on a whim. I started doing the Ustream thing just for the heck of it. And we got so many viewers yesterday that when I got home, there was an email from the people at Ustream. Literally, there was an email from the marketing department at Ustream going, "You have so many viewers, and we have no idea who you are. What are you doing?" We normally, people who have that many viewers, we have some sort of affiliate program with them, or you know, we have some sort of relationship with them, or they've signed some sort of advertising agreement or whatever, because only bigger projects have kind of those kind of numbers. And I went, well, I really had no idea. I thought I was just going by who was in the room, in the chat room, and who was kind of listening on Twitter. But apparently, any given time, we had 13,000 to 8,000 viewers kind of right out of the box with no – I mean, other than me tweeting about it or talking about it on air, no other source. And they ended up putting us on the front page or whatever, and I think it jumped a lot. So that's really cool. So hopefully that part of it grows. I will be streaming it on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday of next week. And hopefully what I'll do is there's a little kind of frame around where I can fit in when I'm doing the show. So I'll try and dress it with, you know, kind of like Japanese sticker pictures. You can get little hearts and Hello Kitty up in the corner just to give it a little pizzazz. Because right now it just looks like I'm broadcasting from my cell. But you know, a cushy cell, a soundproof cell, but a cell nonetheless. We have a ton to talk about today. Like I said, in the second hour, we are actually going to have someone from the Center for American Progress coming on to talk about healthcare. And then in the third hour, we're going to have somebody who's calling in from Copenhagen. Very exciting to talk about climate change. Obviously, you guys know this is a big issue with me because I, like some of you, not all of you, but I, like some of you, use the climate. I'm a big fan of being out in the environment and actually take in some of the chemicals that are in the environment. I'm a big fan of oxygen and nitrogen in the proper balance. I think it's good today. I'm not against expressing an amount of CO2 from my own body because I know it helps trees, and in turn the trees help me by converting it back into oxygen. I do also recommend, though, that we kind of find some way to limit our CO2 output, because one car in its average day puts out about as much CO2 as about 10,000 people. So basically, for every car that's on the road, that's 10,000 people who can't breathe freely, if you really want to look at it that way. We'll talk about those elements of it. Absolutely, I'm a tree hugger. Somebody in the chat room just called me a tree hugger. I actually am not a tree hugger. The bark is really too scratchy. And I live in California, where we have palm trees, which are even worse, you know, because they got like scales. It's like hugging a dried out old lizard. It's just not the same as, you know, a nice birch, you know. You got to be very choosy on which trees you're hugging. Absolutely. I'm more of a bamboo hugger, quite frankly. Yeah. I'm a big fan of bamboo as a renewable resource, and I grow it in my backyard. I have these enormous bamboo stalks. They spread everywhere. They're impressive. Now I need pandas to eat it. No, they eat eucalypt. No, that's koala bears. I'm drunk. Never mind. That's, of course, a euphemism. All right. So we're going to get to a bunch of that in the third hour. We're going to talk about why, I think us damaging the climate is a bad thing, and why the willfully ignorant among us seem to think it's no big deal and are completely comfortable with it, either because they think it hurts business. If businesses don't have the right to poison us, how can they survive? How am I supposed to run a fertilizer company if I can't dump all the waste into the groundwater? I mean, it's just not profitable if I can't dump crap into the streams and rivers and poison generations of children. I mean, what about my bottom line? So we'll deal with that some in the third hour. And of course, in Christmas news, I need to jump on this. Obviously, there are a lot of charities that are hurting this holiday season. And if you can, instead of a gift or in addition to a gift, if you can just go online, there's so many services, so many different charities that allow you to give donations in the name of other people, from everything to, you know, the Red Cross and the Salvation Army, to even your Brendan's buddies, who we talked about yesterday, who was for that kid who's 14 and may run to the limit of his medical coverage. He's going to hit about $1.5 million that he's needed in medical coverage already. And once he hits that point, he can no longer get insurance from his company, and he's already sick, so he probably wouldn't be able to get new insurance. All the more reason to pass the reform bills that are through right now. And as we say in the music industry, fix it in the mix. I'm also a big fan of the Lily Clara Foundation. For those of you that would like to Google that and throw up some links in the chat room or in the the lovely Twitter feed that we have, that's terrific. But pick your own. You know, really do that. I'm Farm Sanctuary. Obviously, you see, if you follow me on Twitter, you see I'll put up info for them all the time. Do what you will. But the point is, if you can't find one, if you go through and you go, you know what, Hal, I don't care about animals or kids or the environment or people who are sick and are going bankrupt because they were, you know, I mean, hey, they got cancer, is their problem. I don't know. You know, I just don't feel it. I'm all Bob Humbug, and I can't get behind that kind of charity. Just none of it moves me in any way. I think I found one for you then. If none of that moves you, then I think I found one. Apparently, Glenn Beck needs a new car really bad. And this is directly from Glenn Beck's website. While Glenn Beck has meet, by the way, it's instead of met. While Glenn Beck has meet with former presidents, had dinners with governors and played with dolls at a Super Bowl party, there's one thing he's never done. He's never been the owner of a Mercedes S600. Now is your chance to make a real difference in someone's life. $1 at a time, the Glenn Beck program is working to fund the Glenn Beck New Car Fund. This event will not be funded by any corporations. This event will not be funded by radio stations. This event will be funded by you. Please send $1 a day per person in your home. So if it's just you who listens to Glenn Beck and you're addicted to this program, but there are five other people in your house who wouldn't participate, you know, throw in a buck for them anyways against their, you know, forced donations, which sounds like socialism to me. I'm taking your money that I would have given you in a gift form, and I'm giving it to Glenn back. But whatever, we'll sidestep that or whatever. Please send $1 a day per each person in your home. We will not accept donations in excess of $1 per person in your home. Our goal is $147,625. And on the site, by the way, Glenn Beck makes an estimated $23 million a year. The same way P.T. Barnum did. There's a sucker born every minute, and it's easy to leech onto them. So, if you look on the site, he actually, and by the way, Crooks and Liars has the link up for that. If you look on the site, they actually have the breakdown of the stickers. So you can see the model he's getting and all the extras. So you can feel like you're really seeing it spent, you know, because some of the complaints that have happened over the Red Cross and in some cases the Salvation Army is the money they spend on overhead, you know, that it should be going to help people, and here they're on administrative costs. They're spending 30% of the money coming in or something ridiculous like this. You don't have to worry about that. You do not have to worry about that. If you want to give the make it a Glenn Beck Christmas, 100% of it goes to the charity itself. It all goes to paying for that car, unless you count taxes, which he probably wouldn't pay anyways because he doesn't believe in the country. Whatever. Anyways, so that's – if you're really hurting, if you can't bring yourself to go to farmsanctuary.org or follow them on Twitter at farmsanctuary and see all the good work that they do, or Lily Claire Foundation, which is a personal favorite of mine for a lot of reasons, some of them obvious and some of them personal. If that doesn't move you, then you always can rely on Glenn Beck to provide you with an outlet for your charitable giving needs. That by no means has any connection with the government, because the last thing any of us want to be doing is providing for others via government channels. We want to do this through as many private corporations and as possible. Now, the Republicans got a special gift in the last couple of days, a really beautiful gift from the Democrats. It's the gift that gave itself. Alabama Representative Parker Griffith switched parties this week from Democrat to Republican. Most of the Democrats in many ways won't miss him because, among other things, he did not vote for the stimulus package. He voted no on the stimulus package. He voted no on the president's budget. Voted no on the American Clean Energy and Security Act, the Affordable Health Care for America Act. Voted no on financial reform legislation. And voted no on Lilly Ledbetter on equal pay for women. He's also a big fan, and this was probably the big thing that drove him ultimately, big fan of the Missile Defense Shield. You know, that useless piece of technology we've been pouring money into since the 80s to fight the Soviets. yeah. Anyways, he was a big fan of that, and I guess Obama's lack of support for technology based on the 1981 game Missile Command was the last straw for Parker Griffith. And so we lost an Alabama Democrat to the Republicans. Now, poor Parker Griffith, apparently he's not being welcomed very much because the Tea Party side had already run somebody against the Republican in the primary. You know, they were already planning on that. Now they're really running against him. They view him as too Democratic because he voted yes on eight of the elements of the president's budget, even though he didn't vote for the budget itself in process. Whatever. Anyway, so he's not nuts enough for them. So they're going to run someone against him. I'm sure somewhere, you know, wedged between David Duke and Ted Kaczynski. So they're going to be a Tea Party candidate down there, an Alabama Tea Party candidate. An Alabama Tea Party sounds, I don't know, it sounds, I don't know, it kind of like a bad sexual euphemism. or a gave her an Alabama Tea Party. Is that wrong? I'm sorry. I probably shouldn't even talk about that on the air. Is this wrong? Maybe there is one. It could be. So there's, yeah. Or some sort of a drink. Doesn't it sound like a drink? Like, yeah, give her an Alabama Tea Party. Yeah, heavy on, yeah. You know, and add extra orange juice to cover the roofie. That's a, so he, the Alabama Tea Party is going to be running against Parker Griffith, the former Democrat, representative, Democratic representative in Alabama. And I guess, don't let the door hit you where the good Lord split you, I suppose, is what the caucus will be saying. We're going to take a break. I'll be back right after this. Our 1-800-STEP-12 is our number. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in for Stephanie on The Stephanie Miller Show.
Kid tested, John Conyers approved. It's The Stephanie Miller Show.
Show. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in for Steph and the Mooks while they're away on vacation. 1-800-STEP-12 is our number. We're talking about healthcare today. We're talking about climate change today. We're talking about how badly Glenn Beck needs a new car and how it's your responsibility to give it to him $1 at a time. Amazing. Amazing. And, by the way, in the other WTF category, this one's kind of amazing. So President Bush's George W. Bush, former president, thank God, his presidential library is producing a television show on public TV, on PBS, called Ideas in Action. The show will be hosted by the group's executive director. So the think tank, the George W. Bush Institute, their head is going to host a show called Ideas in Action, based on the because the think tank that George W. Bush put together in association with the Institute is not just about sitting and thinking. And he wants to make that abundantly clear that we're not about thinking. We don't want to be a think tank. We want to be a do tank. We're going to be a big do tank. We're going to do lots of things. We're going to do all over. We're going to do. It's a do tank. It's a big tank of dew, is what it is. So he is actually, yeah, he was not happy enough for it to be simply a think tank. He wants to do all over the country. Well, as you'd think he'd done enough of that over the last 8 years. We're going to take your calls after the next break, but I want to, I'm also going to deal a little bit today with Iran, because there's been some movement over there, and sometimes that country only seems to be on our radar when we get some threatening news handed to us by either the mainstream media over here or by our politicians like John Bolton. So I want to address a little bit of that, but I will be taking your calls. Alex in Plymouth is on the line. We'll get to him right after this. I'm Hal Sparks. I'm filling in for Steph. 1-800-STEP-12 is our number. We will be back right after this. Good part, Tony. This part right here. It's Hal Sparks. I'm filling in on the Stephanie Miller Show, playing a little bit of Substance D in the background. One of my favorite bands that went, you know, relatively unnoticed, you know, by the, you know, and, you know, we all have gem bands that we like a lot, and the guitar player in that band produced a lot of my my band's record. And engineered the whole thing. He's Mike Parnon. He's a very talented dude. He actually is the sound guy on America's Got Talent right now. So the comparison of what this guy is capable of is stunning. Like, because that's what he normally plays. My stuff is the kind of stuff he likes in general in music. And then he, you know, he'll Weekly is doing, you know, I dream a dream of dreaming of time, come on, you know, like that kind of stuff. So it's kind of amazing. He's got an amazing range, that guy. I want to play a clip before I get to some calls. I want to play a clip of Howard Dean. Now, Howard Dean came out, and it was very widely reported that he said, just kill the bill. That's it. You know, kill it. This is ridiculous. This is just a giveaway to the insurance companies and da-da-da-da. Now, there was a 400-page amendment to the bill, a change in it that was made before the vote, in between when he said kill the bill and the clip that I'm going to play for you. So there, you know, it's not like he just did an about face on his own principles. There actually have been shifts, and I'm going to address some of those shifts in the next hour, especially. But let's play. This is him discussing. John King is asking him about, you know, why he has changed his position on the bill.
I would certainly not vote for this bill if this were the final product. But there are the House bill is quite a good bill. This bill has improved over the last couple of weeks. I would let this thing go to conference committee and let's see if we can fix it some more. Because what needs to be so there's a lot of things that need to be fixed. But if they are fixed, you may actually get the foundation of a bill coming out of the House. If most of the House provisions survive, then we could have a bill that we could work with. But this elimination of the public option is a real sticking point.
My question was, without the public option, is your position say no to the bill?
My position is let's see what they add to this bill and make it work. If they can make it work without a public option, I'm all ears. I don't think that's possible.
Look. Okay. So John King, you know, is I'm not a fan of John King. If you listen to what John John King and David Gregory as well, the both of them seem to lean, you know, they want to be the old guard style, the silver hair on the channel, and so they're trying to, you know, create this kind of I'm the next Tim Russert, I'm the next Walter Cronkite in a lot of ways. I'm the sedate voice of reason. But at the same time, they always drive towards let me get the hot quote. You kind of have to pick one. You're either going to be the legitimate, you know, the Charlie Rose type where you're legitimately having a conversation, or you've got to, you know, or you'll just kind of pull for random quotes. You want to be the TMZ reporter, essentially. So he's looking for, you know, him to say, I wouldn't support this or whatever, because that's the hot quote. Okay. The reason that Dean is now supporting this is, A, again, there's a lot of great stuff in the House bill. In committee, these two get joined together. If they can hold on to the votes in the Senate while maintaining some of the best parts, and then there have been a couple of things added that lay the groundwork legitimately for the creation of a public option, for even moving towards a single payer over time. On the Wonk Room, I think Igor Volsky, who we'll have in the next hour, makes a really excellent point that it's the equivalent of you buy a leaky fixer-upper so that you can get indoors, or you spend the next 10 years homeless. And this is really the situation we're in, unfortunately. But the nice thing is at least you can get in under a roof and start building the foundation of something great. I'm a big fan of single payer. I think we need to get there. I think this is a way to do it. Obviously, holding out for it has not helped us so far. We don't have it currently. This, you know, at some point you have to reassess your plan and see if you can actually, if it's the plan that's keeping you from your goal. So anyways, I want to take a couple of calls. Let's go to Alex in Plymouth, Michigan. Alex, you there?
Yes, I am. And thank you for taking my call.
Absolutely.
I'm very disappointed in the health care bill as it stands right now.
The Senate bill, you mean?
Yes, the Senate bill.
How do you feel about the House bill?
Well, the House, okay. Now, I just heard your argument about adding some good things in the House bill. Mm-hmm. Whether or not that survives is problematic. But a similar analogy would be saying, well, the Vietnam War was good because we built a couple houses or we built a couple schools there.
I don't think that's a sound analogy, and I was the captain of the analogy team in high school. Well, I don't think that holds. I think it's a little bit more like if you were, I mean, because going to war and dealing with the, like a national, it's as if, let's say, we are building the national highway system, okay, and the goal is to have paved concrete roads that stretch all the way across the country. And this step is actually the plotting and cutting out of the roads and not the laying of the concrete everywhere yet, but only in the main traffic areas, but to build the pathways to having it built fully over time. And I think that's a little bit closer to what we're really looking at here.
Well, the problem is, we'll say Dwight D. Eisenhower administration that actually built the federal highway system mm-hmm. actually advocated for a federal highway system. They didn't advocate for dirt trails down, you know, throughout the country.
But over, I totally advocating. Agree. But at a certain point, it took a long time for that process to happen. We definitely had a big mobilization for a lot of those areas, but a lot of places in the country, a lot of states balked at it and pushed back. And had less of a response, and then you didn't bring the resources, didn't actually build out a system that's just, you know, like the highways in certain states are better than others, and we have a sort of a similar situation. The mandate. That's why I'm just saying this is a slightly better analogy. Ultimately, we ended up with a highway system across the country that works very well. And ultimately, I think we will end up with the healthcare system, at least the insurance coverage system. The system itself, in some ways, works fine. It's the payment aspect that's the problem. And so that's what we're really trying to solve. But are you advocating sort of a baby with the bathwater kind of idea? Do we chuck it and start again?
Well, I would tend to advocate that. I understand Howard Dean is sort of backpedaling and will say, well, let's look at the final product. And I could say that, too. But right now I'm extremely disappointed in the corporate Democrats and the Obama administration. They have never came out strongly for a national health care or anything close to that. And that's why we've got what we've got right now.
Well, I think they have. I think they've just not come out for what was quoted as the public option throughout. And I know a lot of people advocated for that. But a lot of people like me actually look at Medicare as actually, and I appreciate the call. I look at Medicare as a real option, the expansion of Medicare, because the system and the bureaucracy is already there. Setting up a brand new public option as we viewed it and as it was presented in the bill was going to take years, and that was one of the reasons why the benefits of it wouldn't be held for years, but the taxation on it would be an issue for a while. So in many ways, the expansion of Medicare over time, or the existence of nonprofit insurance companies set up as corporate entities that are not technically the government but are overseen by Health and Human Services, that seems to me to be an equivalent of the public option that makes sense, and may even be to some degree superior in that regard. The whole point is that we want to get everybody covered, and we want to make sure that companies can't dump you for having a pre-existing condition, or that you can, if you get sick, you can still get coverage. One of the things that keeps coming up, and we'll address this in the next hour, is that many people are worried that according to the Senate bill, seniors can pay up to three times as much as young people in the federal exchange, three times as much. Currently they pay up to 11 times as much. This is a cap. This is not an addition. And what they're using is they're using this three times to scare everybody, when in practicality, the actual experience that most people are having is they're paying up to 11 times as much as someone just 20 years younger than they. That's absurd. And this actually helps in that area. But because you can take the number and go, well, seniors have to pay three times as much as other people. Well, not only are they paying, three times as much versus 11 times as much, but the cost itself is going down. So they're paying three times as much of a lower number. So on all fronts, it helps in this area. And it also leads people it leads us in the direction where we can, through reconciliation, through budgetary process, set up a public option in the future. It just does. And as long as that part remains, and I don't think it will be weakened by the House. It's already in the Senate. They've already got the votes for it. It's going to, the vote's supposed to happen tomorrow morning. If that remains, we really are on the path to getting everybody covered for reasonable amounts of money and for solid coverage. So, there's a lot of this I want to get to. Do we need to take a break? Tony, how are we doing? Let's take a break real quick. I'll come back out to this because we have a bunch of calls and I want to have time in the bottom of the hour to talk to you guys. 1-800-STEPH-12 is our number. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in for Stephanie Miller on the Stephanie Miller Show.
Coming up after this commercial, I will be talking even louder.
It's the Stephanie Miller Show.
Sparks, I'm filling in for Stephanie Miller while she's away on vacation. I thought that was kind of appropriate. It's a nice little place. We got to remember, we're 11 months into the Obama administration, and we're still finding old food in the fridge, as it were, from an apartment standpoint. We cannot lose sight of that part of it. 1-800-STEPH-12 is our number. We got a ton of calls, and I want to get to them. Let's see. Michelle in Milwaukee, because I have friends there. How you doing, Michelle?
Very fine, thank you. And I wanted to say thank you for stepping up here during the show and stepping up for Stephanie here.
Oh, absolutely. Anytime.
My comment is not so much about the content of the bill. I have to be quite honest with you. I don't think I have read everything. My comment is more from an outsider perspective. I'm recently became a citizenship about 2 years ago, and I became a citizen to vote, to have the right to vote and to express.
Sure.
I've been living in France, I've been living in the UK and in Canada, where, you know, we have single payer and universal health care.
Uh-huh.
What is more disappointing to me is the process, the entire process, and basically what the senators have shown about the way they handle democracy. And my comment here is the following. If 60% of the people in the states are for health care, how can a senator today go in the Senate and defend an opposite position? That kills me, quite honestly.
That I completely understand, and I'll tell you why. This is a situation in this country. I'm going to let you go because I have a lot of noise on your line, Michelle.
You.
But merci beaucoup. The big issue, I think, is because you have, you know, Senator Nelson, for example, his entire state, which he represents basically 50% of as one of its two senators, has fewer people in it than any major city in the country, the entire state. And it creates there's an imbalance in our system caused by that situation. And it's hard for us. It's just one of those things we have to kind of swallow on occasion, and it's really tough because you've got literally a majority of Americans whose votes count less than someone who lives in a smaller state. If you live in Montana or Nebraska or Kansas, a state with fewer people in it, your vote kind of counts more because your senator has equal pull with the senator from my state of California or a senator from Texas or a senator from New York or Florida, who have much larger populations. That element of representative democracy, you know, obviously in the Congress we have, you know, it's by district and it's a little more even. But in the Senate, that's where the power play really happens. And that's a tough one. You know, that's why those tend to be states with a lot of pork, that they tend to be states that don't use their pork for anything. You know, when you allocate funds to a big state, that's money that's usually needed to be spent. In a smaller state, they have some roads to fix, some state buildings to build, and that's pretty much it. There's not enough people there to fill out those kind of elements, you know, and that's why most of the payments, the cash for cloture that came through, that went to Nelson and goes into actual services, goes into actual money that doesn't actually build infrastructure, those kind of things. It tends to, you know, go towards, things that are spent immediately. I'm not crapping on the people who live in those states per se, but it is an odd imbalance. That's one of the things we have to, have to deal with. By the way, today is Hump Days with Hal. It's just completely Hump Days with Hal, I guess. But there's no one around to hump. I'm just not interested in Tony. It's not the way I go. Not that you're not lovely, and if you met someone, I'm sure they adore you. But, yeah, it's just not. And it's, you know, and the girls are all out in the hallway. It's just not practical. It's just not feasible. There's not. It can't really be a hump day, so it's all got to be just upstairs, which it usually is anyways, because there's nothing happening between me and Steph. It's just not. I mean, like, I'm long suffering. I will continue to. I'll fight the good fight, but I'm not. I have no illusions about that. I'm gonna go change gears a little bit. I want to go with Josh in Madison. Josh, you there?
Hey, Al.
Hey.
How you doing?
I'm spectacular. Thank you.
You have no time to answer that question, but that's all right. I was listening to pretty much every second that you've ever said. I've been a fan of yours since like before Talk Soup and that kind of thing. So,
oh, thank you.
I'm really, really glad to see that you're on the radio. Anyways, I was going to bring up a couple things really, really quick, hopefully.
Uh-huh.
I was listening yesterday about you saying how if the states had to decide civil rights and that kind of thing, nothing would have really ever happened.
Right.
And then I was also going to say sort of it's kind of a surprise, though, because places like Iowa, for example, are, you know, voting in favor of marriage equality
right.
before any other places, too. So you never really know if you turn it into the states, they might do something like that.
Well, I meant on a state level, I think you're right. What I meant is if you put it up for a national vote at the time, there was, you know, if you spread it out over the entire country as far as population base and that kind of stuff, you would have really run into a wall of especially in the civil rights fight. David Bender pointed out after the show when we were talking, whatever, that the civil rights fight in large part started in 1893. Mm-hmm. And if we want to kind of compare that on the timeline of getting health care and balancing ourselves, and recognizing that stuff like this takes a huge shift to come about. And I think the issue of gay marriage and a marriage equality across the board is a similar fight. Obviously, we give and we take during the entire process. But I think the slow, steady march of progress in that way is formidable. And I don't think it's going to change. I think ultimately we're going to marriage equality will be the law of the land because it will be the way people feel.
Right, but I think probably in the same way that the slavery issue or, you know, civil rights and sort of thing would have eventually become the law of the land as well. It just would have taken a little bit of time.
Right.
I just have one quick other fast thing to say.
Sure.
Also. It's kind of like, I've been a Green for as long as I was allowed to be a Green, essentially,
right.
as long as I could vote. but, I figured, like, it's getting to the point with the Democratic Party where if I, you know, do any kind of canvassing or any kind of calling or any kind of, you know, money giving or whatever, it's kind of become like a Lucy in the football sort of thing. Like, I think that something's going to happen, and I feel the same kind of way about Obama, too. Like, I figured, you know, change, whatever, here. And then it gets yoinked again by, you know, the Democratic Party, which I'm, you know, not going to vote against, obviously. But
I hear what you're saying. But you have to look at the list of things that they've done this year in 11 months that are extraordinary. And like
right.
I said, the only reason we're arguing about health care and what would be best and the processes is because he's the first guy to bring it up in 16 years. You know, essentially. And the last time it happened, it was, you know, they did it in a way that everybody seems to think he should be more forceful. He should push this through. Well, the last time, that's what Clinton tried, and it didn't work. It never even got to this part.
I mean, Bill Clinton got hunted the entire time he was in office.
Totally. As is Barack Obama. And it's worse because he's black. And I have no qualms about saying that there's a big chunk of the Tea Party movement and a big chunk, and I'm not going to say all of them because I don't necessarily think that's true. I think some of them are just politically moronic. You know, I think they're just kind of lose sight of what their idea of liberty is, just bananas to me. You know, because their idea is give all our freedoms over to a corporation instead of protecting them with legitimate regulation. Right. It's absurd.
I can totally vote out a CDO if I want to.
Yeah, right. Exactly. You want to hand over your health care to companies like AIG and Enron and they one day they disappear, you know. The government protecting Social Security. We want to privatize Social Security. Right. So like Ford did with all their workers' pensions, you mean. How about that?
Right, exactly. Exactly.
One day you wake up and they've just voted it out of existence.
Oh, sure.
Right.
And then the last thing I've got is I'm just going to say we're always talking about how, you know, the sausage is being made in politics
yep.
and that kind of thing. And I'm from Madison, obviously. So just thinking that Russ Feingold himself doesn't make sausage. He makes steak.
That's a which is still an ugly process, and I don't eat it. But I get what you're saying. I got to take a break.
Sure.
Thank you so much for calling. I'm Hal Sparks, 1-800-STEP-12 is our number. I'm going to get to some of your calls after the top of the hour, and then we're going to have Igor Volsky next. 1-800-STEP-12 is our number. I'm filling in for Steph. It's the Stephanie Miller Show. I know you're anger. I know you're dreaming.
gentlemen, it's the Stephanie Miller Show.
The Stephanie Miller Show. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in for Steph and the Mooks while they're away on vacation. 1-800-STEPH-12 is our number. I'd love to hear from you. We're talking about health care. We're grinding down to the final vote before the holidays. The Republicans were going to filibuster to the bitter end. They were going to delay everything they possibly could. They were going to hold out until Valentine's Day. That was what they said. We're going to be through. We don't care about Christmas or New Year's. The hell with it. We're staying here for, you know, as long as it takes. And then yesterday they kind of actually told Senator Reid that they'd kind of rather go home for the holidays. So basically the vote's going to happen tomorrow at 8 a.m. on the Senate bill, and it's going to go through because they know they have the votes and they're just holding it back, which is it's like a, you know, I hate using football analogies. It's like just using timeouts instead of, you know, when you know you're losing the game anyways. But that's what they've been doing. They've just been digging their heels in, going, you know, maybe a day will make a difference. Well, a day does make a difference, especially if you're about to lose your health care and you have a pre-existing condition, or you're a woman and your insurance company views rape or domestic violence as a pre-existing condition because you have a tendency towards injury, I suppose. And this is what they are thinking, that you make bad choices and therefore cannot be trusted with your own body. This is, yeah, so it's very important that the Republicans hold out until New Year's or Valentine's Day to keep you from getting that, because heaven forbid. Okay, so let's see. Darlene in Tempe, Arizona. Darlene, you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Hiya.
And I'm a constant listener to the station, and mm-hmm. of course Stephanie usually brightens my day until this all came up. the fact that they have to want to rush and push this through before Christmas is totally ruining my Christmas. I spent hundreds of hours campaigning for Obama, and honest to God, through five states. I'm a small business owner. I belong to national organizations and know people across the country.
Right.
And I talked so many Republicans into voting for him. So many people that just don't vote to register and vote for him and stuff. And now they're all mad at me. I have two grandsons, but that was their first vote of their life. They just became old enough to vote. They voted for Obama. And they told me, Grandma, when I voted, they actually welled up with tears.
Yeah.
It was so emotional to them.
Right.
This man sold us him to love him. I mean, I just loved him and his family and, mm-hmm. and every, so that's why we feel more double-crossed, more betrayed, more, you know.
What was the big betrayal? The passing of the stimulus package, the Lilly Ledbetter Act,
no,
the first Latina on the Supreme Court?
I'm just talking about health care.
Just health care alone.
And
the fact that, by the way.
Okay, this is a big thing in people's lives.
I understand.
60 Minutes Sunday, there was a woman on there just with one sad story. There's a millions of them across the country.
Sure.
And these people are having a hard time finding a roof, getting a roof over their head. I know people, even though it's not me. I know people who, have a hard time eating now and having a roof over their head. And now they're going to be mandated to be at the will of these rip-off insurance companies.
Well, keep in mind, if they're making a decision, if they're at a level as far as finance where they're deciding between food and rent, There are provisions both in this bill and in the House bill to cover that, to make sure that, you know, they're not being – this is not going to be an extra amount on top of them. They're already covered – they would be covered by Medicaid in this situation.
I don't really have faith that that's going to happen.
But it's in the bill.
And everybody, I swear to God, everybody is as livid as I am.
That's because they're not paying attention. They're livid because – I'll tell you why. Because they're buying what's being sold –
we're going to lose the next two elections because the Democrats.
No, we won't. Because I'll tell you why. The same thing is going to happen that happened with the Afghanistan escalation. It was, I believe, something he was quagmire he was handed. He made a tough call after a genuine review.
I have no problems with that stuff.
Okay.
I mean, he was handed a bunch of crap.
Sure, but when he did,
this affects our financial life monthly. I pay over $700 a month because I'm in the stupid donut hole with Plan D.
Right. Which which this addresses.
Barack Obama, behind closed doors, met with Big Pharma shortly after he became president and kept this Bush's Plan B going. And this $700 a month I spend on drugs doesn't count towards.
Well, this will also this the Senate bill actually has provisions to address the donut hole to fix that gap. And that's in the Senate bill. And the Senate bill is the less of, you know, of the two bills. That's the one that people are less of a fan of.
The House bill we want.
I know. But the House bill also has the, like a similar provision. Both of them cover the donut hole. So what I'm saying is what people are getting upset about is not actually the policy that's there. What they're getting upset about is certain buzzwords that they don't feel like are being delivered on. And then their desire for a pill to fix it as opposed to an exercise program
people
to solve it.
People can't afford this mandate. And don't you remember when Barack was campaigning, he said the only thing that would keep the health care is honest is competition. And
right. And that's why in this.
No competition.
But in this, why in the Senate bill. Keep in mind, he hasn't signed a bill yet. This is still going to committee. This is going to be reconciled with the House bill. If you have an issue with it in a lot of ways, you know, it's in the process. And I don't know what, let's see.
We've all called the White House so many times, it's not even funny.
Well, great. And that's good. However, what I'm trying to say is that this bill hasn't even gotten to his desk yet. And people are calling it an utter failure in that regard without any recognition of what it's actually solving, what it actually does. If this bill
has to be finished in the next couple of days, that's ridiculous. It's not going to be fixed.
Well, no. I mean, a lot of it lays the groundwork for us to build on this system in the same way that, it was because Medicare was an incremental growth in this country, as was every other major change in policy in this country. This is a huge shift. And a lot of people, I think, are backing out.
And healthcare companies, that's what it's a shift to.
Well, for one,
healthcare companies, mandates. My poor grandchildren that can't find a job because of the job situation in Phoenix.
Right.
And they
if they do not have a job and they don't make if they're not making a living, they're covered by this bill. They will be provided with Medicaid as an option. If they're within 150%, the Senate bill offers 400% ahead of higher than the poverty level. So which under Obama is actually, you know, one of the goals they have is to raise what we consider the poverty level in the country because it's been kept artificially low. So if you don't have a job and you...
That's not true because my grandson can't qualify for anything because his parents make too much money. Well, his parents don't give him a dime. He doesn't live with them anymore. He's 20 years old. He's on his own.
Well, then he should qualify. He does qualify.
But they held his parents' income against him. What's up with that?
Well, that's before this bill goes into action. This is part of the reforms we're talking about. You're talking about Bush-era policies and how they're affecting
you're
them.
Right, but I really, really feel you're just full of false hope.
Well, I think I'm a pragmatist. I think we need to make changes in a lot of this, that everybody's system so far has gotten us exactly where we are. At a certain point, you have to look at your life and your circumstance, and especially where we are as a country, and go, our behavior as Democrats heretofore has led us to exactly where we are, which is last time around, we put it entirely in the president's lap, and they were able to shut him down. And this time around, Obama said, I'm going to engage with the Congress and make sure that they have skin in the game. And this is what we've gotten.
Harry Reid is such a wimp.
Harry Reid has managed to...
We're not in power.
Harry Reid has managed to... And I'm not a fan of Harry Reid, but he has managed to garner 60 votes and stop a Republican filibuster so that this bill can go through, so that... where we go from 56 million people uninsured to 26 million people uninsured just in the Senate bill alone. That all pre-existing conditions are gone. What I'm saying is I think you're buying the party line, hook, line, and sinker that anything short of absolute is a total loss. And I think that's a shame. And I think that's one of the reasons why the Republicans, and I thank you for the call, it's one of the reasons the Republicans have such a stranglehold on the Supreme Court that they've had. I think it's why they have, quite frankly, so much input in the military, is because over time they recognize that that the slow drip, rivers come drops at a time. And I personally, as a human being, as an American, I'm sick to death of this wringing of the hands, throwing it up. If we can't get everything we want right away, then nothing is good. It's absurd. It's not how policy is actually made. It's not how change is made. And it basically, you just end up writing off the country. At this point, you worked in an election. You spent 11 months. There have been more incremental changes this year than in the last 8 years. 8 years we have of George Bush that put us in the financial hole that we're in. There was not a a single movement to improve health care in any way under the Republicans. They never tabled it. They never would. They don't care. And Obama came in and made this a priority, and his priority from day one has been to make sure that the uninsured have access to health care. That the idea of a mandate that everybody seems to be freaking out about is mitigated, all that cost is mitigated out on people who can't afford it. If you can't afford it, the government sets up a situation where you can. There will be nonprofits available in this in the exchange. This is a thing that's been added recently. It's just absurd to me that people just will not grasp that huge changes like this have to be done incrementally. And I am this is coming from someone who is a fan of the single payer idea, but I'm also a pragmatist. I want this done. I don't want to take my ball and go home Kucinich style every time I don't get what I want. It's absurd. It's how we end up in two wars. It's how we end up with something like the Patriot Act. It's because we either fear speaking our mind and continuing the fight once we've lost a single battle, or we just remove ourselves from the process. The other side doesn't remove themselves from the process. And this weak-kneed, phony, whiny crap that I hear all the time, and this is what sort of Chris Matthews was talking about the other day, and he caught a lot of hell from Bill Press and a couple others, and I totally don't think he speaks to everybody who's just criticizing the bill. That I'm for. If you've got an issue with the elements of the bill, keep it up. But what point do you think somebody in the middle of the civil rights fight would go, you know what, I just don't think... You know, I don't think black people should have that. I mean, I think they should, but I've tried. I've worked for almost a year, and black people still can't marry white people and still can't get equal rights when they, you know, there's no such thing as an equal opportunity employer. That concept took almost 20 years to take hold after the civil rights. It's absurd, and I am tired of it. I'm fine. I am 100% fine with criticism of the bill and the idea that we want to move forward. But the idea that you want to just shut this down and start over, that's what's gotten us where we are. So other than that, I have no opinion. we got to take a break. 1-800-STEF-12 is our number. I have a ton of calls. At the bottom of the hour, I'm going to have Igor Volsky to come on and talk about it. He's got a lovely article on the Wonk Room on Think Progress about precisely what I'm talking about, the upside of this bill. So I'm Hal Sparks, filling in for Stephanie Miller. We'll be right back.
Oh, my God. That's like my favorite show ever.
It's the Stephanie Miller Show.
Hal Sparks, a.k.a. Dr. Love. thanks for playing that, Tony. It cheered me up after that last call. I tell you, this is what I've kind of decided after, because we hear this repeated meme, and a lot of people who bring this up, this idea that I campaigned for Obama and I'm not getting everything I want, so next time, screw him. I'm not going to show up to vote and blah, 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 blah. These people strike me as people who got into the Obama campaign and as if they were getting into Twilight or Lost or became a fan of Dexter. I liked it last season, but I don't like it this season. And it's this absurd kind of pop culture concept. Look, either the point was, you know, that you believe about these issues and they matter for you for life, or they don't at all. If you are a person of principle and you believe in health care for everyone, then you don't just give up at the first sign of not getting 100% of you want. You recognize that the people you elected are doing the best they can, and you push it even further. I think that's what you do when you're a person of principle. Quite frankly, if you got into it just because it was, you know, you got caught up into it like it was a book you were reading, then of course next you might just kind of drop off. You might go, well, I'm not with the plot this time around. It's more important than that. Either you believed in the principles he fought for and you continue to believe in those principles, or you never did and you're just kind of caught up in the pop culture aspect of it, which is fine when you're watching Rock of Love, but sucks when we're dealing with people's lives. And I think this throw up your hands and I don't know what I was thinking. This is not change I believe in. Lindsey Graham said yesterday on George Stephanopoulos that this is not change you can believe in. And I heard him turn Obama's phrase on its head, and now I don't believe it either. It's ridiculous. So let's actually, I've got how much time we got? Because we got 3 minutes. So let me take a couple calls because there have been some people who have been holding for quite a while. Mark in Minneapolis has been holding the longest. Thanks, Mark.
Hi, Al. Listen, you know, we are going to disagree here. You're calling a lot of these listeners weak-kneed and whiners. We're angry because we don't see change. We see the same type of activities taking place with different color uniforms. And
Do you really say, in the last eight years, honest to God, in the last 8 years, did you see a single Republican or independent for that matter, single Republican ever present a single change that's even in the Senate bill, even the ones you consider the lamest aspects of this bill, which include not allowing people to be denied coverage for a pre-existing condition. That very thing was that ever presented by any Republican ever?
What I'm saying
was
is
it,
that
was it, listen to me,
detail.
Was it? No. The answer is no.
Okay, we just passed financial reform that exempts 90% of all derivatives from being regulated under the new rules and exempts 8,000 of the 8,200 banks from oversight. Now, that's what I'm afraid of.
Well, they already have pre-existing oversight.
No, do they? Like Sarbanes-Oxley oversight, like the SEC oversight that allowed Madoff to continue for 10 years?
Right, under Bush, absolutely. Okay. It's not the organizations, it's the people you put in charge of them. This is what I've been saying all along, that it matters who you put in there. The problem with New Orleans was not FEMA. The problem with New Orleans was who Bush put in charge of FEMA and the priority he made around it.
We're talking about Bush and Katrina. We need to talk about now. Convince me that this healthcare legislation isn't, filled with big corporate giveaways. The litmus test should be the reimportation of drugs from Canada and Europe should be included. Medicare should have the power to directly negotiate for lower drug prices. That should be included.
Well, I'm a fan, and that's in that element was presented in the House bill, and it's an option to be added later. Again, a lot of this stuff can be added in reconciliation, whereas without this bill,
just get financial reform
without this bill, hold on, without this bill going through the way it is, we start from scratch every single time. And we have to get 60 votes, and if we don't have a majority, that just goes away. If we get this through, we can pass all the things that you want through reconciliation, through 51, through a simple majority. I don't know. Are you going to give up and stop fighting for it? Are you going to give up and stop fighting for it?
Oh, absolutely not.
Well, then I don't think we will then. Eventually it will go. I've got to take a break. I understand. 1-800-STEP-12 is our number. I'm not calling everybody weak-kneed. I'm just saying the people who want to bag out and not be involved in the process, that I consider that weak-kneed. 1-800-STEP-12. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in for Stephanie Miller. I'm Al Sparks. I'm filling in for Stephanie Miller this week, and do not bring me your impotent anger. I am not here to hear it. I am I'm like our former president George W. Bush in that way. I'm a do man. Now, all this thinking. For those of you who weren't following in the last hour, George W. Bush's institute is going to have a show called Ideas in Action on NPR because he wants his think tank to be about do. The point I've been trying to make, and I made in this call, and we've got Igor Volsky on the line, I'm going to go to him in just 1 second, is that if we give up on this as it goes, we start back from where we were, and if we lose the next one, when is this going to come around again? The next, I want this here, I want this done so that everything we need can be built incrementally. The other side has no problem with that. Our side tends to be a take our ball and go home style. On the line with us, by the way, is Igor Volsky. Igor, you there?
Hey, Hal.
How are you?
I'm good. You know, I'm happy to hear you say that we should move this bill forward, because over the last couple of weeks, we've kind of had conflicting messages. You know, we had Howard Dean come out and
right.
say you need to kill the bill. Then on he said that on Tuesday. Then on Sunday, he said we should move this bill into conference. So, you know, our side has been a little schizophrenic about what we want to do. But you're right. You know, it's either this bill or nothing. And when you have that kind of choice, I don't know how you can take nothing.
I know. Well, that's the thing, is that the conservatives never have this problem. This is the one area where they excel at, which is they understand incremental change, and they also are good at mobilizing people and continuing to mobilize them, even though their causes never get answered. If you look at abortion or any of, like, prayer in schools or gay rights, any of these areas, they really don't actually move on any of them, but they continually are able to motivate their side by saying that they will, you know, and our side, you know, if we don't move on it exactly as we want, like 100%, our side goes, well, you're not doing anything, and we go home and we play Xbox. And
our leaders also are just not very good at talking to the progressive base. I mean, you
right.
had President Bush throw them every bone in the book, and here we have President Obama saying he didn't even run on the public option, apparently.
Right.
So it's just very confusing. You know, a lot of us are very disappointed to see that interview where he said, I didn't run on the public option. 95% of what I asked for is in this bill. I mean, it's just silliness, really. It's very disingenuous.
But I also, I do stick with him in that regard, is that he did not run on it. He said he thought it was a good idea. He supported it at times, but he didn't go 100% double down on it. His idea was, let's get the goal done. If the public option is the way to do that, great. Then I'm for it.
I'm with you on that. Yeah. Look, if we can achieve the goals of the public option through regulatory means, I'm all for it. But the guy put it in his campaign plan.
Right.
He was talking about it left and right. He was saying it's the best way to achieve competition, choice, affordability, quality. You know, I think that he should have a measure of disappointment that many progressives feel. Even those who still support the bill are very frustrated.
Sure.
It's just
that
not
I get.
A, it's
I
not
totally
a political
yeah.
move. I don't think.
I also think, though, that there's an element. You know, he's a pragmatist in a lot of ways, as am I. You know, and that you can't get too disappointed if you get 95% of what you want. It's the truth. And you can run on every presidential candidate knows they can run on anything they want. Once you get into office and you see what's actually possible, you know, stuff always changes. And that doesn't necessarily make you just disingenuous. That doesn't mean you're going back on what you said. You're going, okay, what can I do now, and how can I get there eventually? You know, and
well,
I get that.
I think that's true. And I think once all of us kind of step back from this feverish pace, everything's changing. You know, last week we didn't even think we had 60 votes. Now all of a sudden we do. And once we step back, we'll realize that this president is in his first year, and he accomplished something, or is very close to accomplishing something, that people have been trying to do for 87 years in this country
exactly.
or something, and have failed. So it's a remarkable achievement, despite his, I think, you know, very problematic. Problematic political moves in terms of whether or not he retains the progressive base for the rest of his agenda.
Sure. Well, I actually think all of us, the genuine progressive base, cares about these issues. I think we will care about immigration reform the same way we've cared about it. I think we will care about jobs bills the same way we care about it. And I don't think any of us are going to, become quote unquote disloyal based on, you know, an element of the bill, even if we. You know, I really think we're there for the long haul, but as frustrated as we get.
I think we want him to defend progressive ideas.
Right.
That's all we want. We don't want him to say it's either you take the public option or nothing, but we want to hear that he believes in these principles, and he's going to defend them in private conversations to moderate Democrats.
Right. Well, I think, you know, again, do you think that's a problem he runs into in navigating the Senate, and that if he does that, that exposes the belly, as it were, and leaves him open to, okay, well, he said without this, he's screwed, and therefore if we can stop this, then we stop him.
Well, no. I think the way he's handled this has been fine up until now.
Okay.
I think if he came out and said, you know, all of us are disappointed that the public option isn't in the bill. It was, you know, a very good way of achieving the goals we wanted to achieve.
Mm-hmm.
But again, this is incremental reform, and hopefully we'll see a public option down the road. You know, we're already expanding Medicaid, he could have said. 15 million Americans are going into Medicaid under this reform. So we're making slow steps in the right direction. But I think, you know, what he's setting up by saying that it's 95% of what we wanted, we got to remember that until 2014, nothing is implemented, really. I mean, very few things. And so,
well, a bunch of the regulatory, you know, and I on your article on the Wonk Room, which is terrific, that the denials for pre-existing condition, women being charged the same as men, senior difference, that all goes in immediately, and that affects.
And it does, and it's significant. I'm not saying it's not, but my worry is that as we go through, you know, the 2010 elections, the 2012 elections, where you're going to have insurers do what they're already starting to do is jacking up rates in anticipation of these new regulations,
like credit card companies have done once they put up the Consumer Protection Bill of Rights.
Exactly. So if you have that such a political environment where health care reform passes and health care costs premiums keep going up, I mean, that's just a toxic political environment for Democrats to run. And that's my concern, that he's overselling this. He's hyping expectations. And then for 4 years, nothing really happens. I mean, you point out there are important reforms,
right,
but they're not the body, the breath of the bill, really.
I agree. I don't think they're sexy. I don't think 30,000 troops to Afghanistan is a sexy change on it, but I think he put a lot of thought into the policy shift, and I think he went, you know, kind of holding his nose into the into the situation and made what he thought was a smart move on it, regardless of the blowback of it. And I think there's some qualities that can't be lost on it. Not everything is sales, and I think making these incremental changes eventually, like with the decision about Afghanistan, the public has shifted since. In a positive sense, it's drifted back up. During the whole debate about it, it tanked out a little bit. But now it's starting to come back. People are, in regard to Afghanistan, going, okay, at least he's thinking about it. At least we're making policy decisions based on progressive ideals and eventually getting out of there. That at least that's, I think, public perception in that regard has shifted. And I think healthcare is the same way. I think part of what is driving, some of the blue dogs to feel like they've got some cover in this area is that idea that a lot of these changes aren't sexy and don't come quick enough. I think it would be nice if some of them went in right away. I'm a big fan of the expansion of Medicare, but if you've got people, one person, you need every single vote, and you've got one person who will dig in and kill all of it, I think you have a responsibility as a leader to go, if I put a public option in this, or if I come down too hard on it, they're going to use this as a whipping point, shut the whole bill down, and it'll be a win for them in the next election and a loss for all of us. And I think the smart move is to get this done. And it's
I agree with you entirely. And, I've been very disappointed to see blogs like Fire Dog Lake and very, very loud and strong and brave progressive voices, Jane Hampshire and Governor mm-hmm. Dean, who thankfully walked back his comments, to come out and say, just because it doesn't have a public option that now all of a sudden you have to kill the bill. I mean, you got to remember that the public option that we had in the Senate was just, as Anthony Weiner says, a sliver of competition.
Right.
That's all.
It was terrible.
It was opt out. It didn't have Medicare rates. The premiums would have been higher. It would have maybe saved $3 million, the CBO said. I mean, it was just very small. But the real foundation of reform are the regulations, are the good coverage pieces. The public option was maybe a brick, but that's all it was in that foundation. And it's really, I think, disingenuous that now they're rallying against the individual mandate. They're making alliances with the Tea Partiers. It's just
right.
Very, very toxic. I just hope that that they come to their senses, that maybe we can improve the bill a bit in conference, which I think is important
on
the regulatory end.
Right. I agree. I mean, I think, is the goal of everyone. And I think that's the goal of every bill that goes into conference. We all hope for that. But I also think that, when you've got a situation where you need 60 votes to just get this moving every time it comes up. And you have an opportunity, a historical opportunity, like you said, not in 80 years, not, has this been possible? You know, Clinton, even at the height of his popularity, in a much nicer financial climate than Obama finds himself in, and not in the middle of two wars, still put it on the table, still said, I want to make sure this gets through, and it's actually going to happen. Then everything that we want from this can happen via a reconciliation vote later on because it's already in place. And I think that win is more valuable than any single element. And because of that, I think it's a smart political move.
You know, and I think if the purists were around back in 1965 when we passed Medicare, which at the time was a relatively modest, I mean, it was a tremendous accomplishment, but it was a much smaller program than it is today, that we've expanded it year after year. I mean, they would have filibustered that plan as well.
And, no question.
And look at the success it is. Now they actually want to open it up, but it's
Ronald
followed.
Reagan put out a record about socialized medicine that was sent out for free to households so that people, little coffee clutches, could sit around. I got to take a break. Can you stick with me through the break?
Sure.
That would be awesome. Igor Volsky from Think Progress, The Wonk Room, among other things, healthcare researcher, blogger. You're great. Please hang out with us. 1-800-STEPH-12 is the number. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in for Steph, and we'll be right back after this.
She's your human Prozac. It's the Stephanie Miller Show.
Stephanie Miller Show. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in for Steph and the Mooks while they're away on vacation. 1-800-STEPH-12 is our number. And I'm glad to still have with me Igor Volsky from Think Progress. You've done actually reporting for Fair and Accuracy in Reporting, Hudson River Valley Institute at Marist College. So I greatly respect the amount of detail that you put in your stuff. And I think this is a great conversation that we're having. That's why I wanted to keep you over through the break, is this the fortitude it takes to make the kind of change we're talking about. That change we can believe in is not something where we all clap and Tinkerbell comes back to life. It's, you know, it's incremental. It's tough. There are fits and starts. There are unfortunate compromises and important goals that are automatically reached in some cases. And we need to, if we believe in these ideas, have a long view of what we want and the recognition of the work it will take. You think?
Yeah, I agree with that. You know, one of the interesting moments during the floor debate, and, you know, it's been going on for like 20 days now in the Senate,
right.
But yesterday, Senator Baucus came to the floor, and, you know, he was so angry. I've never seen him so angry. Did you see that?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, he was shouting at Senator Wicker from Mississippi, because Wicker had suggested that the reason why the Gang of Six negotiations fell apart was because they went to Europeanize healthcare, and Baucus said, that's not what happened, that's not what happened. Your leadership drove them away. They wanted to pass reform. Your leadership drove them away. You know, and for all the compromises that Obama had to make, I think it's worth noting that Republican obstruction, you know, the Senate Finance Committee bill had so many Republican ideas, things like high-risk pools, like catastrophic care for young people, no public option. Mm-hmm. The list goes on and on and on. Selling policies across state lines was in the bill.
Right.
And these are straight from McCain's campaign program, we should note. And they still walked away.
Right.
They still walked away. That he, Baucus, met them halfway, and they refused to even take any steps towards him.
Right. And then, McCain is on I think Meet the Press this weekend, saying that, you know, Obama's coarsened the dialogue in the Senate and made it more contentious because not a single Republican was invited into this process, which is the most absurd notion. Even if you look at recently, I think it was Chris Dodd, they've been trying to work on the Senate Banking Committee, where they've been trying to, you know, create this regulatory reform. And Chris Dodd's methodology for this was to pair groups, couples, you know, like almost boy-girl style, with one Republican and one Democrat so that they could pair off in teams and work on reform. Literally going one Democrat, one Republican, even though that's not the balance in the Senate and in the House right now, we're going to act as if, and we're going to allow you to have your input. And still nothing. Greg comes out and says, Judd Gregg comes out and says that it's wonky, irrelevant, wacky socialism, and they're not going to participate. And then later on, what they'll say is they were left out in the negotiations during this whole process. They're not going to vote for it because it was all done behind closed doors. Doors that they walked out of the room and closed the door behind them. It's not closed doors when you shut it yourself.
You know, as the bill has become more conservative, the attacks, the criticism has remained the same.
Right.
So it doesn't matter what's in the bill. They'll stick to their you know, nice, comfortable frames. But in terms of McCain, you know, he's on the help committee in the Senate. The help committee produced a bill. I watched the markup. They had about 10 days of markup, if not more, 12, I think, in the help committee. He was there for one day.
Right.
He was there in the beginning to complain about the CBO score. That's all. So if he wanted to be, as you point out, if he wanted to be involved in the process, he had the opportunity. He just wasn't there. Now he's just grandstanding.
Right. Well, and he also came out, you know, recently, and Rachel Maddow actually had to, C-SPAN had to reload footage from McCain a while back. Because he came out on the floor and he said, when Al Franken cut off debate, when Joe Lieberman was talking, he said, you know, I got to cut you off at 10 minutes. He goes, you know, can I extend my remarks? And Al Franken said, no, in my position as the senator from Minnesota, I have to object. And McCain stands up and says, I've never seen in this body this kind of behavior that somebody can't have an extra, you know, 30 seconds or a minute to talk or whatever. When he himself, during the debate on the Iraq War, said that he objected. You can actually hear. Do we have the clip, actually? Yeah, let's play that real quick.
Opine, and I realize that lawyers and others can change.
Your time has expired.
As for unanimous consent, I might have 30 seconds to complete my.
I object.
Objection is heard.
That was McCain himself. Who just this week said, you know, that I have never seen anything like that in my life. It would almost be understandable if McCain, you know, wasn't there and somebody else had called it. But it was actually him. That's the amazing part.
Now, McCain has held every position twice, and during the campaign when I was writing about his health care plan, it was so much fun because he would say one thing, and I went back into the records, and 95% of the time, I don't kid you, 95% of the time, I discovered that he said something else. On health care, his big point on the floor has been that we're changing the way Medicare Advantage plans are reimbursed. These are these Medicare HMOs, Medicare Part C.
Right.
Of course, during the campaign, he proposed the same exact reform to Medicare Advantage, which is they compete on an equal playing field with each other without the extra government subsidies. Now he's against that.
Right.
You know, when you don't play fair, when your only goal is to win seats in 2010 and not to try and solve this health care crisis, I personally think we've given them too much time. Then after the Gang of Six, we should have said, all right, guys, we spent months and months and months. This bill reflects your idea. You don't want it? We'll just do what we want without regard for you, because clearly, you know, there's no interest, no interest.
Well, and by the way, they always float stuff before it happens as a straw man, but just to guarantee that it doesn't. It's kind of, you know, it's like paying for abortions with federal dollars. Not going to happen. Wasn't in there. Wasn't going to expand. That wasn't going to change. Yeah. But they wanted to make sure that language got doubled down for campaign reasons and for their own reasons. We're almost out of time, but I want to thank Igor Volsky for being with us. I like reading your work a lot. I think it's very well researched and very well argued. I appreciate it greatly. That's why it was great to have you on today. It was funny that I pulled your articles before I even knew you were going to be our guest. It was I was going to talk about it anyways, and that's a great thing. So I really appreciate it. Igor Volsky, thinkprogress.org and the Wonk Room, thank you so much. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in for Stephanie Miller. 1-800-STEP-12 is our number. We'll be back in a little bit.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's the Stephanie Miller Show. I'm walking on sunshine.
the Stephanie Miller Show. Welcome. Happy holidays. It's our last show before we are off tomorrow and Friday. I'm Hal Sparks filling in for Steph and the Mooks while they're away on vacation. I guess they're not away. They're actually probably just hunkered down at home getting paper cuts from cheap wrapping paper. That's why we use tissue at the Sparks household, because it looks nicer. You know what's my big secret for wrapping presents is in Los Angeles? L.A. Express. There's this kind of seedy newspaper that they give out that you can get for free on the and it's got strip club ads and massage parlors and escort ads or whatever. And I use it as wrapping paper for when I give guys gifts, because it's very funny and kind of weird. And the funny part is, I guess maybe there's a law about in the L.A. area that survives from 1910 about legitimate news, that you have to have a certain amount of legitimate news in a paper. So there's somebody who writes movie reviews for the LA Express and writes articles on healthcare on the back of it. I won't be quoting them anytime soon, but I just think that's hilarious. That somehow, you have to, there's like a law about legitimacy that still expresses, still survives in the LA Express porn paper, which is very funny. But it's, yes. Crispy X in the chat room says it's not a CD newspaper. It's alternatively decent. And I think that's a great way of spinning it. I have to, in full disclosure, Crispy X is actually a dear friend of mine, but I won't give out his real name because he doesn't need that kind of attention. 1-800-STEPH-12 is our number. I want to switch gears this hour a little bit. We've been talking about healthcare, and a lot of it is great. I mean, obviously, we had Igor Volsky last hour, and we were talking about what's good in the Senate bill, what could be saved in the committee process with the House bill. So I want to, everybody knows how I feel about that part of it. And I think the important thing always, is ever forward. This is the important message, I think, if I have one. It's ever forward. I get the bill is not a 100% win, but I really believe that, this kind of progress is better than none, and none is what we have had since the 60s. So I'm willing to give this president the benefit of the doubt that he actually is laying the groundwork for something positive to happen. And when you have on the other side, not only people, Senator Coburn wishing that in an ever so subtle a way something bad happened to one of the other senators, so they can't vote. And everybody took that as he meant Robert Byrd, who is the oldest member of the Senate, and his health has been bad. Do we have that audio? Okay. So Inhofe, who's one of these other, he looks a little bit like Mr. Bean. He's kind of one of the hardline senators who's been against this. He's on, I think it was on C-SPAN. And a caller calls in. Apparently, Inhofe didn't show up for one of the votes. So let me see. Who was it? So one of the GOP senators was in there. I forget who it was. But anyways, you'll kind of hear. It's really about the caller. Inhofe didn't show up for the vote, one of the Republican senators. And a guy called into C-SPAN to talk to one of the GOP senators, and he was very concerned that they had prayed for the death of one of the senators, and the prayer had missed and hit one of the Republicans. Like, prayer has bad aim. Like, all they went, oh, I forgot to say his name specifically. I prayed for the death of a senator and we killed one of our own. It's all right. This is the guy who called. It's nuts. Listen, this is a teabagger calling in.
Colbert's instructions and prayed real hard that Senator Byrd would either die or couldn't show up at the vote the other night. How hard did you pray? Because I see one of our members is missing this morning. Did it backfire on us and one of our members died? How hard did you pray, Senator? Did you pray hard enough?
Okay, stop.
Senator Bass,
that's actually, that's serious. That guy, we all got together, we prayed for Senator Byrd to die, and then I noticed that one of ours had shown up, and he's crying. This guy's crying because, A, Robert Byrd didn't die, and he was afraid that his prayer had killed Inhofe. This is what we're dealing with. This is your alternative. This is, you can have a president who makes health care a priority, a Senate and a House who puts through a health care bill that keeps people from being denied for pre-existing conditions, makes health insurance providers have to charge women the same as men instead of more, that lowers, instead of 11 times seniors are paying for coverage, lowers it to 3 times, no cap on lifetime benefits, guarantees a position for nonprofits in the exchange. Nonprofits that will be run, by the way, by a government agency to keep them honest, so effectively a public option, allows the opportunity for Medicare to be expanded, that's already in both bills, and can be expanded even more in the future. There's nothing that precludes it stopping at that, which is great. Or,
we pray for the death of other people. Vote for my candidate. We're the Pray for Death Party.
This is your These are your alternatives. You're going to take your ball and go home. These are your lesser of two evils. This is what you decide is the lesser of two evils, right? That makes me nuts. Okay, so let's take that. Oy gah. Let's take that and start talking about climate change. Okay, because people argue that, you know, there's not a mandate for health insurance. I don't have to get insurance if I don't want to. Of course, you can't, you know, you can mitigate illness on a certain level. You can certainly protect yourself as much as possible. But let's say you're massively injured in a car accident and you're the one breadwinner in your home and your injuries require you, require massive surgeries to keep you alive, and healthy, and you're going to lose your job and you have no insurance, your whole family is going to go bankrupt. End of story. No question. That's the way it is currently with the system, the way it is. Okay. There's also a cap on the number of surgeries that you can get. So let's say you get enough surgery to keep you alive, but the surgeries that would make you healthy enough where you could work again and actually provide a for your family, those aren't covered. That's after your cap. This bill takes that away. That, you know, these are your alternatives. And your alternative to not actually dealing, you know, with these issues and solving them is I'm going to stay home and let –
I prayed for the death of somebody, and I think I prayed for the death of the wrong person. Senator, did you pray hard enough for somebody to die? What kind of a Christian are you?
This is the easier choices, kids. And this is not a lesser of two evils. The drop-off is really huge. It's like, between a pickpocket and a serial killer, technically speaking, the pickpocket is the lesser of two evils. Would you flip a coin if one of them got to stay at your house tonight? One of them gets to stay in your house, and this is your choice. A pickpocket who may or may not rob you, and a serial killer with a history of having sex with the corpses of his victims. These are your choices. I mean, seriously. This is what you're talking about. I mean, really. You're going to go, it's just a lesser of two evils. I don't feel betrayed by Obama because all he did was get 95% of the things he campaigned on in a bill. When's the last time you saw any politician get 95% of the things that they campaigned on in a bill? Seriously. And then you're going to go, I'm just going to stay home so that the Tea Partiers can show up in droves next election because you're just fed up that Obama had the nerve to walk into office and sign the Lilly Ledbetter Act, the you know, equality for women in pay, to guarantee that if a woman finds out that if she's been denied equal pay for decades, but because she didn't find out within 90 days of the first paycheck, she can't sue for back wages and she can't do anything about it. That's the way it's been forever. Obama comes in and says, I'm making this a priority. This has to be done. We do this now. And it's done immediately. And you're going to, you know, and people are going to go, oh, I can't, I don't know what he, I don't know him anymore. Who are you? Who are you, Obama? I can't, what do you mean you put through the stimulus package and and even though you worked with the other side, you still managed to do this and the economy's starting to turn around and your next job is to take the profits that we're actually getting from the money that we loan to the banks at interest. You want to take that interest payment and roll it back into the economy in a jobs bill. I don't know who you are, Obama. Who are you? This is a horrible betrayal. I'm embarrassed. I would much rather stay home so that the Pray for Death Party can show up in droves and fill the entire political system with Vitters and Inhofs and
I think we should get together in large groups and pray for everyone in Iran to have a heart attack.
Like, this is because whether or not you think your anger is justified, this is what it buys you. This is why we are where we are with climate change. This is why we are with environmental issues, because a lot of people who are very passionate about environmental issues tend to go when we abandoned Kyoto, tend to just kind of back off, like, I'll just kind of recycle. That's what I'll do, and I won't really be involved in that, and I won't call my senator or my congressperson about how serious this is. I'm sorry. I'm actually making people wet their pants in the chat room. they like the comedy, funny, stupid guy voice, which is, it's funny that that's a real human being, because it sounds vaguely like Brack from Space Ghost. Hey, buddy, I don't believe in this kind of reform. Yeah, buddy, I believe in praying for the death of everybody. Oh, boy. So, I mean, there are people who talk like that. Oh, good Lord. Anyways, so my point is, you're either in it for the long haul and you want to actually make these changes, or you don't. And you either double down on making it better all the time, or you don't. And I have no tolerance for the fallback position. I just don't. Not after 8 years of Bush. Not after New Orleans. Not after not a single Republican ever making a beneficial push for health care reform. Except to create a donut hole in Medicare. I mean, this is really the only thing we've seen from them ever. And allowing people to back away from their support of Clinton. I have my problems with NAFTA and that. But insofar as, his push for health care, people letting the fact that he had, infidelity issues back them far enough away from him for the Republicans to run in, come in with the long knives and eliminate that as a possibility for 6 years. And then, and then Bush coming in, and we reelect him twice, sort of. We reelect, in quotes, him twice. And after 8 years of that, I think people are letting their frustration with him boil over into Obama and what's really practically getting done. And I think that's, I think it's absurd. I think it's backpedaling, and I think it's silly. And I'm happy with him. I'm happy there are people like Al Franken in the Senate. I don't like Harry Reid, but I think he's done good work in that regard. And look at that. I'm just blowing through this hour. I cannot be stopped. It's all this chat room stuff. I want to get to some of the calls after this break. And coming up at the bottom of the hour, we have Julian Wong, who's going to be with us. He's from American Progress. He's going to be talking to us from Copenhagen. How international has the show gotten already? So if you're in Copenhagen and you can see us on Ustream, by golly, and you see a guy kind of on the phone in the hotel lobby, It might be Julian. So we'll be back right after this. 1-800-SEP-12 is our number. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in on the Stephanie Miller Show. Happy holidays.
Highbrow, lowbrow, unibrow. It's the Stephanie Miller Show.
Cool part again. 3, 2, 1. Oh no, there's one more. There we go. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in for Stephanie Miller while she's away on vacation. Of course, playing Christmas songs the entire time I'm here. That one goes out. That's a Christmas jingle. Goes out to my cousin Kip Loretta, who is a huge Soundgarden Chris Cornell fan, and with good reason. Seriously good music, seriously talented guy. We are talking about, I want to talk about climate change, because up in the next half hour, at 8:30 our time, we have Julian Wong, who's a senior policy analyst at American Progress. He's going to be talking to us from Copenhagen. you know, Obama's obviously had, you know, some disappointments in trying to work with the Chinese and trying to work with India, because quite frankly, as they grow their middle class, that's a huge number of people with all kinds of cars and electronics and the kind of things that add poison to the environment. Now, here's the thing. I am a big believer in I don't need conservatives or Christians who, you know, believe the earth is only 6,000-7,000 years old. I don't need them to believe that man controls climate change. I don't. I don't. That doesn't concern me at all. What I need you to be concerned with is pollution. Whether or not you think car exhaust goes up into the sky and punches holes in it is immaterial to me. The truth is, the practical concerns as far as the damage it does to physical people here on the ground and to the groundwater and to the plants and to our ecosystem and to animals that we consume if we are so inclined is way more important. And if we solve that, it helps. The climate change issue. You know, it's like that, you know, that in the early days of Earth Day, the big argument constantly was, you know, think globally, act locally. I think we have to think, you know, more like think globally, act in an interstate manner, because I do think we have to look a little bit bigger than just our own, you know, you want your fluorescent light bulbs, you want your recycling bin. I'm for that part of it. But you also have to, you know, recognize that when laws come up that limit the amount of pollution and strengthen the EPA in those regards, we can't let these people who just believe that Jesus wants the earth to catch fire at some point to not care about what our environment is like and allow children to be born with birth defects and have people develop mesothelioma and lung cancer because we just don't care about the chemicals we're putting into our environment. It's silly. It's silly. I think, you know, Carlin made an excellent point, which was that, you know, the planet isn't going anywhere. We are, if we're not careful. And unfortunately, we're taking a lot of animals with us that didn't do anything, that didn't deserve it, per se. We sprawl into an area, and then we fill it with, you know, benzene and split. And that's not right. So I want to see what kind of changes we can make as a culture, not just as individuals, but as a culture, because that's what it's going to take as a shift. And I think the shift towards dealing really with our pollution impact versus our climate impact is a better way of talking about the issue. Like I said, coming up at the break, we've got after the break, we've got Julian Wong. Julian is the I want to get this right too, because he works in on a range of issues. He's the senior fellow at American Progress. He's a Fulbright scholar in Beijing, researching China's renewable energy policies. Biggest economy on the earth after ours. And is growing incrementally, like, stronger. We really need to start dealing with this. I'm Hal Sparks. This is the Stephanie Miller Show, 1-800-STEP-12. We'll be back right after this. Stephanie Miller Show, 1-800-STEP-12 is our number. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in for Stephen the Mooks while we're away on vacation in the bottom half of our last hour for the week. Everybody's on break except Tony, who will be get 5 more hours of sleep this tonight than he got last night, but still not enough. Still makes you a crazy person. But hopefully over the holidays, you'll at least have one day off of Christmas Day. You'll be able to sleep through stuff with your family. Good. All right. On the line, I'm lucky enough to have Julian Wong, senior policy analyst for American Progress. Julian, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thank you for having me.
Oh, glad to have you. On the show, I've been talking about climate change sort of from the practical aspect of I think people don't have a connection to the word climate any more than they have a connection to the word environment. But we all understand pollution and our own output. And
right.
I think the dialogue would be served if we shifted to that direction. But what do you see over there? I'm curious as to, you know, because obviously there's insofar as what we're getting over here is that it's a very frustrating thing and nothing is happening.
Well, do you refer to the what's happening in the international dialogues, international negotiations? Or,
yeah.
Sure, yes. Well, you know, I think what came out of Copenhagen, understandably, has been met with a lot of, I'd say, with disappointment in the public opinion. And that's because, I think, largely because the expectations going into the summit were very high. However, I think, you know, for those of us who have been following the negotiations pretty closely, going into the summit, I think expectations were not that high simply because of the difficulties in arriving at a consensus over the wide variety of issues over the past 2 years of negotiations.
Right.
So I think going into the summit, I think the managed expectations was something in the order of a two-step process, that Copenhagen would be the first step of coming to a political agreement on several high-level issues, but to set a pathway for more legally binding agreements in the next 6 to 12 months. And I think to a large extent that was achieved. I think while it's easy to say that nothing legally binding came out of Copenhagen, I do think that there are several things worth taking home as small victories that will get us to a legally binding agreement hopefully in the next 6 to 12 months.
What do you think those points are?
Sure, yeah. I think there are key three areas. The first is that for the first time ever, we have created a mechanism for both developed and developing countries to pledge commitments on climate action. In the past, under the architecture of the Kyoto Protocol, this was really limited just to developed country actions. And I think so that is the big change coming out of Copenhagen. The second thing is financing. You know, the climate action is not just about each country taking commitments for deep cuts, but also recognizing that different countries have different capacities and recognizing that developing countries in particular need some financial and technological assistance. And so the commitment was made in Copenhagen to provide $30 billion from 2010 to 2012 to help developing countries. And this figure would rise up to $100 billion a year by 2020. Mm-hmm. And so that was a big big achievement coming out of Copenhagen.
Go ahead.
And there's just one final thing. I think, you know, there's always concern about transparency and whether countries will stand behind your actions. And I think also there was a lot of headway made in terms of coming up with a viable mechanism to make sure that every country is living up to the expectations.
Right. This has obviously been a point of contention between, what's gotten the most plays, of course, between America and China, and with India being a secondary player that's really difficult. What part is the European Union playing in this, in that regard? Because we hear almost nothing about that aspect.
Well, yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I think, you know, part of the reason is of the focus on the U.S. and China and partially India, as you point out, is because these countries haven't been meaningfully integrated into the international agreement architecture in the past.
Okay.
So, you know, EU has been there from the start,
right.
And they are clearly the early movers on climate change action. They have their whole carbon trading emission scheme up and running since 2002. Meanwhile, you know, the United States is still debating the merits of enacting a similar sort of system. So I think because Copenhagen really represented the opportunity to get the United States and China in particular on board, which is why a lot of the focus was on these two countries.
Gotcha. Okay. So, there was some, concern that blew up the whole thing, that they just aren't going to play in the sandbox with America in that regard, and that was the end of it. When it seems to me, insofar as I've traveled to China, I see them actually making a lot of headway. Obviously, their problem is with the massive economic growth that's happening to them kind of quickly. that causes, you know, more people to have cars than ever before and that kind of thing. It's just sort of natural growth as opposed to the unnatural debt-based growth that we've had in the States for a while, where people who didn't need them had two cars just because we could. There's just people who never had this stuff before are now having it, and that's going to make more of an impact. And yet, at the same time, they're doing great work, I think, with Beijing and Shanghai, making them, you know, greening the cities, and you at least hear a lot of lip service about that. Where was their big hang-up point, do you think?
Well, you know, I think what's interesting about China, and which can probably be said for a lot of other countries, is that China is willing and has been shown it's willing to do a lot more than they're willing to actually commit as an international obligation. So while it might seem that like their targets, the carbon reduction targets, for instance, may seem to be unambitious by many, they are actually taking a lot of ambitious steps domestically, just in terms of deploying renewable energy, increasing energy efficiency, and with China, they're really all about long-term planning. So they have like a plan till 2020 in terms of renewable energy deployment and energy conservation. So, you know, I think it's a delicate balance. You know, on the one hand, they know it's in their self-interest to clean up the economy, to manage their economic growth so that it's done in a sustainable manner, because they know that at the end of the day, you know, pollution issues are going to come back to bite them if they don't manage it properly.
Right.
On the other hand, in the international arena, in just the nature of these talks, negotiations, you know, they also have a responsibility to look out for their own interests and not to get ahead of themselves. But I think we see that with many other countries too, like India. Again, they're another example of a country that has been willing to take a lot of domestic steps, but when it comes to negotiating some sort of position in the international arena, they appear a little more conservative.
Right. I think that's been consistent with them in a lot of ways. Is that it's you know, they've been very comfortable, sort of, you know, surrounding themselves with a wall in a lot of ways, still doing the stuff and being involved, you know, listening in on the international movements and the sort of change in ideas that are going around the world, but just doing them on their own and kind of hiding behind, you know, almost like promising very little, delivering a lot, but the delivery is really just for them. Just because they're recognizing that they've got so many people packed into so many enormous cities that you just have to deal with this, and they're just doing it from a practical standpoint. But that decision has nothing to do with the rest of the world.
Right.
Right.
I think that's absolutely true. I mean, you know, they have to juggle, you know, what they have to juggle right now, just in terms of managing the development and feeding the hundreds of millions of people in their population, coupled with these new world challenges of climate change and energy security. Quite frankly, it's an arduous and very complicated task. You know, and developed countries have it good because they've gone through their decades, a century and a half of development, and so they have that part of the equation taken care of, and they are more able to focus on the climate and environment issue.
Right.
So again, you know, I think this just points back to the complexity of the challenge.
Absolutely. And I think largely it boils down to, you know, the economic issues of it, because really what can the countries themselves really negotiate? We can't negotiate about our own people recycling. We have to negotiate about, we'll put a law in place so that, like, you know, certain cities are now outlawing, you know, regular bulbs, and now you can buy, you know, compact fluorescents instead of incandescent. And so, you know, so, like, Canada is doing that, for example, and moving that direction. Those are the things you can kind of you can negotiate. And so is it that there are corporate interests in the States and in China to some degree, because they're a lot more corporate than we, you know, recognize? I think that, you know, in my experience of China, is that they're almost more capitalist than we are. It's just done as Guanxi, you know. It's all done as, you know, just an understood element of just constant graft that you just kind of, this is how I, you know, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours kind of business, regardless of what, we're supposed to be a communist country, I guess, but, you know, everything is for sale there. It's amazing.
Right.
So, you know, is that the run-in? Is that we have, you know, the countries that have more of a, you know, a corporate grasp on their governmental systems have the hardest time negotiating for better climate rules than, say, developing countries or countries with stronger corporate rules like a lot of the European countries, like France and England and the like?
Yeah, well, you know, I think That certainly is a plausible hypothesis. I think we see it in the case of the United States. And certainly when you look at the domestic climate change debate in the U.S., and we see the role and influence of corporate America, very influential, and the views are taken very seriously. I think to answer your question directly, I think it all comes down to what do corporations and business think climate change is? Is it a threat to their business or is it an opportunity?
Right.
And I think that what's going to be important if advocates want to push forward with aggressive climate action is to frame the whole climate change debate as an economic opportunity rather than a cost.
What?
Because and to a large extent, I think the Chinese do understand that this is an economic opportunity. Mm-hmm. They have identified clean energy, new energy as a strategic economic sector.
Right. Well, they're building most of the solar panels that we're using in the States. You know, we're making this mandate that we're going to have more solar panels, more wind turbines, that kind of thing. And then China's jumping on it immediately and saying, we want to build these things. Meanwhile, we've got our companies over here arguing that they shouldn't have to.
That's absolutely right.
Yeah. It's got to be a huge sticking point. Thank you so much, Julian Wong, for being with us. AmericanProgress.org. I recommend people go over there and, you know, if you want to get some, the long notes on these things.
Thank you so much.
Absolutely.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having me, being with us today. Absolutely. Cheers. So, we got to take a break because we only got a few minutes left and then the show's done. I was like, look at that. We're just racing by. It's amazing. So I'm Hal Sparks, 1-800-STEP-12. I don't know if I'll have time for many calls when we come back, but I just want we'll deal more with the climate change where I think it meets healthcare when we come back.
That's the smartest thing I've ever heard anyone say about anything.
It's the Stephanie Miller Show.
Christmas, played on an acoustic guitar by Zakk Wylde, guitar player for Black Label Society and Ozzy Osbourne, and occasionally Lynyrd Skynyrd. Most people don't know that. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in for Stephanie while she's away on vacation. We're in our last little segment before we go away for the holidays for a couple days. I'll be back Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday of next week. We'll be Ustreaming the Hal Sparks Hot and Sexy Cam Show. You can find it on Ustream. You can also go to halsparks.com. It's on a page there. And then we got people yelling for Freebird now. It happens. And then, of course, on Twitter, I'm at Hal Sparks. Don't forget, you can follow Steph on Twitter as well. She's at SM Show, not S&M Show. That's a totally different thing. Don't get confused with that. That's like my dear friend, Mistress Varla, who's on Twitter. If that's the way you swing, she's the way to go. At Mistress Varla. There you go. And then, of course, you can find me on. And then, of course, Radio Guy Chris, who's Chris Lavoie, Boy Toy Chris Lavoie, who's the producer of the Stephanie Miller Show. He's on there as well. Although, you know, I send him love over the Christmas holidays, and then let him get some rest because I think he's far too worried about the show, anyways. But I think it's been good. I think we've, other than the occasional hardcore lib thinking that I've somehow drank Obama Kool-Aid and I can't think for myself and I'm just selling the healthcare bill out of some misguided sense of loyalty, which couldn't be further from the truth. I just require in my life incremental change and I'm cool with that. Anyways. We'll deal with that. I've got a couple calls, and they've been holding on for such a long time. I really do want to get to you guys. So I'm going to go to Cindy in Minnesota. There you go. Cindy, are you there?
I'm in Michigan.
Oh, you're in Michigan. I'm sorry.
In Michigan.
There's light reflecting off my screen. So,
And I really enjoy you, Hal. Everything you've been saying, I thought I was the only person who was thinking that way, that let's get what we can and keep working on it.
Right.
My first thing I was going to say, it's all changed because they had me give a comment, and now you've just got my mind
thinking. Sure, sure. No.
My voodoo doll probably canceled out those Republican prayers. That's my
okay. That was that's what evened it out. Made Inhofe getting out of his limo.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you said something about they had a leftover in the company fridge for Obama. There's still something stinky back there.
Oh yeah.
I don't see it as a leftover in the fridge. I see it as an episode of Hoarders. I mean,
yeah,
I
think that's a great example. Yes.
There's just layers and layers of dysfunction. Junk that was created by troubled people when he came into the presidency, and it's going to take, working those layers down and
So I'm sure you watch, if you like Hoarders, you've watched How Clean Is Your House?
Right.
And the Republicans who are okay with the status quo about the health insurance industry as it is and the healthcare system in our country are like those people who go, I just live here. It just seemed fine to me.
It never bothered me. And that's what I mean by troubled minds. They're just troubled. But the other thing is what you've been saying is I see the Republicans by nature, and this goes to climate change, health care, gay marriage, everything. They are pig-headed. They are the party of no. But they use their pig-headedness to keep winning elections and using their corporate sponsors and their corporate media, even if that media loses money, to organize reactionaries and pay to make things up like the Tea Parties and
the anti-Acorn push and all that stuff.
Right. And we progressives get a reputation for being flaky because we don't play that long strategic game. We play a first quarter and we quit.
Right. And we can't afford to do that anymore.
We need the stamina.
Yes.
To keep going. And that's why I voted for Obama. I saw a man who was in the Senate. He knew how that game is played, and he has played it right down the line.
Yep.
To cobble together 60 votes, when last week we were talking about Lieberman going off
scuttling the whole thing.
And it has just worked around. And now I even saw on television the Republicans are saying, well, we don't have it. We're just giving up.
Yeah, they're going to have the vote tomorrow. they've given in on their filibuster entirely. We'll see what that'll look like when they come back. I thank you for the call.
I love you, Hal.
Yeah,
bye-bye.
I adore you. Thank you for calling in, Cindy. I want to make sure we get to David and Bill. David is in San Francisco. I know Tony doesn't think it's important to get to all the calls. You're just an old school talk radio person, but I think they've been holding on for a long time. David, you there?
Hey, morning, Hal. Yeah, and by the way, this morning,
I've only got a minute or so
sure.
It's all you.
Well, I was interested in this the representative Parker Griffith.
Parker Griffith, right?
Alabama has just switched over parties. He's a physician, and actually, about a year ago, there was we're coming on the anniversary of a massive TVA spill. This thing was 130 times bigger than the Exxon Valdez spill.
Right, I remember that.
And it runs right through his district. And so this is a really good reason why single payer would be a massively useful thing for his district. When you get polluted, you need to go to the doctor to find out what your base level blood levels are, and then after you...
The long-term aspects of that are going to affect you for a long time to come.
Absolutely.
And insurance can drop you because of that.
And the most expensive area of Alabama is Huntsville. They've got NASA, they've got their universities, they've got their Silicon Valley.
I got to run because I'm running up against a break. It's an excellent point, and I thank you for hanging out as long as you did, David. I got 1 minute, and I want to get to Bill in Asheville, North Carolina, because it's Christmas, and I don't want to leave anybody on the line. Bill, you there?
Hey, yeah, I'm still here.
Yeah.
About an hour and a half ago, I wanted to
30
say,
seconds, go ahead.
We need to say, yes, we still can.
Yes.
And I agree with you 100%. Keep up the fight.
Yes.
One quick point. The Republicans are in permanent campaign mode. George Bush governed for 8 years in campaign mode. Barack Obama has shifted to governing mode.
Yep.
And we're not comfortable with that.
We got to go to long game. Absolutely. Thank you so much, Bill. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in for Stephanie Miller. 1-800-STEPH12 is our number. You can call in next week, Monday through Wednesday. I'll be here. You stream. streaming the show. Email me at HalSparks.com. You can find me at HalSparks on Twitter. Thank you guys for being a part of this, because the Ustream thing has just blown up, and it's been fantastic. I love the discussion, and I hope everybody has a wonderful holiday no matter what you celebrate. Take care of yourselves and take care of somebody else, and I will see you on Monday. Thanks so much. Little Skinner to go out.